Welcome to another edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. We're very happy to have you with us again today. A couple of notes before we introduce our panel and start the conversation. Governor Kemp is going to be holding a news conference sometime later this afternoon. We'll carry it on GPB radio and on our social media platforms. He is expected to announce, though, that bars, nightclubs, and live performance venues will remain closed, even as he's opened other businesses across the state or told them they're welcome to open, whether they do it or not. He apparently is going to announce later today that bars, nightclubs, and live performance venues cannot open. So we'll keep you on top of that as it develops this afternoon. I also want to thank you for even more emails. I got a lot again from you yesterday, and I continue to appreciate your telling me what you're dealing with in the virus. As I've said before, I try to answer every email I get, and I will continue to do that. If for some reason you sent me an email a while ago and I didn't respond to you, please ping me again, because I really do think it's important to stay in touch with you and listen to what you're dealing with. Also, I should say in that regard, a number of you have written with issues that you're having around getting an absentee ballot sent to you. Many have said you sent your request to the Secretary of State's office. You've told me that you haven't gotten your ballots yet. We will stay on top of that sort of thing with the Secretary of State's office. But I also will tell you that it's worse, May 12th, we're still a month from the election. The Secretary of State's office has something like 1.1 or so million requests for absentee ballots. So let's see how that develops. And if as we get close to Election Day, say 2 weeks out, you should stay in touch with me about whether you're getting your ballots. All right, enough of me. Let's get to our panel for today's show. It is Tuesday, which means Tamar Hallerman, AJC senior reporter, is here with me today. Tamar, how are you holding up? You're still self-isolating.
I got a new dog last weekend, so we've been getting to know each other, and I've been getting out. It's been great.
What kind of dog? Where did you get the dog from?
I got her from the Angels Among Us. Her name is Winnie, and I got her from the Angels Among Us rescue. She's half hound, half bulldog. So she's got energy, but she's lazy, so she's perfect.
Well, congratulations on having a companion during your isolation. James Salzer is with us. Nobody covers the state budget, follows it as closely as he has for literally decades now for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. James, how are things around your place? You're sheltering in place as well. Are you finding it difficult?
Well, I also have a new dog, and German England is keeping me busy.
Well, thank you for mentioning him, because he is our special guest today. We're really delighted that State Representative Terry England, the chairman of the Appropriations Committee and a state rep from Auburn, Georgia, is with us today. Terry England, you're sheltering. Are you back and forth between the Capitol and home, or are you trying to stay sequestered, to use a phrase?
Pretty much just staying around the house. Been in Capitol one time since March 16th, but we're Zooming and WebExing and all that fun stuff. This old dog, I don't have a new dog, but this old dog is learning new tricks. I think it was appropriate that you said that James had been around forever doing this. As a matter of fact, he's been around. They were typing the paper out on stone tablets and sending it out.
And I certainly believe him when he says you're keeping him incredibly busy. Of course, we invited you to come on with us for the first half of our show today, because we know you're wrestling with an alligator, to say the very least. James, I'm going to turn it over to you in a second, because I want you to help set the stage for the questions we're going to want to ask Representative England. But according to the reporting that you've been doing, James, state agencies have now been told to cut some $3.5 billion total from their budgets for fiscal year 2021, which starts on July 1st. State agencies have been told that across the board, no exceptions, they need to submit budgets that have 14% reductions in what they're asking for in 2021. We had state, just to show how difficult this situation is, James, in April, revenue collections by the state were down, 36%, more than $1 billion. Are those basically the headlines of what Representative England's got to deal with here, James?
Right. Yeah. It's essentially the part of the revenue decline last month was due to them moving the tax day from April 15th to July 15th. So that was part of it. But then those numbers are a little bit misleading because sales tax information is mostly from March, when we were just starting to close down. First half of the month, we were not closed down. So April numbers are going to be much worse, likely. We took away income tax numbers that were coming in, some of the income tax money, but then we're also weren't fully feeling this impact of the sales tax. So, they're going to be, obviously the chairman of the appropriations committees and the governor's office are going to be looking at numbers almost every day, not every day, about what's coming in, because they know the bad number won't really come in. I mean, we'll only see the full effect until about the time the session cranks up.
Representative England, on May 1st, you were one of the signatories to a letter that went out to all department heads and agencies. And here's what you said, essentially, just to summarize a couple of lines of it. We find ourselves in unprecedented times. COVID-19 is dealt a blow to our local, state, national, and world economies. Words cannot express our appreciation for the incredible work your agencies employees have been doing during this time. We realize that working remotely has presented many challenges. However, we have heard nothing but praise for your determination, compassion, and strength. You've proven your commitment to all Georgians. And then comes the hard part. However, you've got to cut revenues across the board. This isn't your first go-round in dealing with a very, very difficult budget, is it, Terry?
No, unfortunately, it's not. You kind of wish these things were kind of once-in-a-lifetime events. Unfortunately, I get to enjoy two of them at least. So, I came into the chairmanship role kind of about halfway through the last recession, stepped in 2011 as we were still cutting, and then wound up with several years of flat budgets, just allowing for increases in enrollment, whether it be for education growth or Medicaid growth, those kind of things. But otherwise, it kept everything fairly flat through all that time. So we get a second bite at this apple, and this one's going to be a little more difficult because the places that we went and found savings during the Great Recession, we've never really added those things back. So it means that these things are kind of that lean muscle stuff that we left and gradually rebuilt from that time.
I have question.
Tamar wants to get a nine.
Sorry for cutting in, Bill. I have a question for Chairman England. There's a chance that Congress could step in and deliver states and cities some emergency aid, but there's some division, especially among Republicans, about whether to do that. And there's certainly some resistance along political lines as well. Do you want to give money to blue states or to cities that have traditionally mismanaged their finances? And I'm curious right now, as it stands, how much you're counting on being able to get that money from Washington in time for the upcoming session?
Well, I don't think we'll see it before we have to adopt a budget to have it in place by July 1. There would be a chance that we see it sometime in July or August, I think. One of the things that we've kind of suggested is loosening of the rules that were tied to the CARES money on the funds that came directly to states too. Right now, those funds just say that you can only use them for a COVID response. But the thing is that those kind of overshot the runway a little bit. I think folks were thinking that the cost of the response was going to be a good bit greater than what it actually has been. It's been significant, don't get me wrong, but at the same time, to the tune of what the federal government sent out to the states, there is a little bit of room there that if those rules were relaxed, we would have the opportunity to use some of those dollars for revenue backfill, too. The debate is, of course, centered around where some of the other, especially some of the Rust Belt states, are wanting dollars to help with their pensions and those kind of things. Well, what we've been telling folks is, look, let's just look at the lost revenue piece. Those pension issues are something that have been going on for decades and decades, and the states like us that have managed our pensions well and have kept up with our required payments there, it wouldn't be fair to us for those states to be bailed out on those things. But if you did something that was just based on revenue, then that would be fair and equitable across the board to everyone.
James?
Yeah. One of the questions I had was, is this all going to be done with cuts? Are y'all going to be looking at, I mean, there's been proposals raised on cigarette taxes. I'm assuming when I go on Twitter, I always see the casino lobbyists saying, you know, hey, maybe we can run at that. Do you think that there will be efforts to raise money in other ways besides the cuts? I mean, obviously you're going to have cuts because you can't raise enough money to make up that 3.5 or 3.6 billion. But what do you think of that?
I suspect there'll be some that bring some measures to the table to look at. I don't know what they'll be. I have been hearing a little discussion on the tobacco tax over the last few days. The thing on casinos, by the time they would get stood up and going, it would not be anything that would be helpful to us at this point. And many others know that I remain strongly opposed to that. But it would, by the time those were put in place and got up and rolling, I certainly hope we're well past whatever impact we've seen before we'd even see the benefit of the taxes from that. So,
do you think cigarette taxes has a chance?
Do I? I'm sorry.
Do you think there's a chance you will see a tax increase on the of cigarette taxes? And you know, obviously, you're probably going to want to throw vaping in there.
I don't know. Like I said, I've just really this week, and this is only Tuesday, have just started hearing or seeing a little bit of chatter going back and forth in some emails as it relates to the tobacco tax. I know there's a pretty good appetite out there among some folks to look at actually raising that, at least getting it up to the kind of southeastern state average anyway.
Right.
Terry, let me jump in. When we talk about the state budget, oh, and by the way, I have to always give a disclaimer when we talk about the state budget. GPB is a state agency, and so we do rely on funds for some of the operations of Georgia Public Broadcasting, and Georgia Public Broadcasting has been asked to take cuts, too. I do also always say when we talk about the budget, the Political Rewind and other programming we do is funded by donations from listeners, not by the money that the state gives to GPV. But you do need to know we are a state agency. Terry, here's what I want to ask you. You know, when we talk about the state budget, there are a lot of people out there who say, who really cares? This affects whether state employees have jobs or not. And we're not worried. We know that state government is often bloated and wasteful. At least that's conventional thinking. But I want to be clear about something here with you, and you certainly can talk about this. If you're going to have to find $3.5 billion in cuts, these are cuts that are not just going to affect people who happen to work for state government. This is going to be across the board. Education is going to take a hit, which means some counties may have problems with paying, having as many teachers on staff or doing everything they want with state money for education. Healthcare can be affected. County health departments can be affected. So this notion that this, oh, who cares about state employees, that would be the wrong way to look at this, it seems to me. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, exactly, Bill. It rolls into so many different things. You mentioned teachers, you mentioned health care, but, I mean, you know, public safety was state troopers, corrections with prison guards, juvenile justice with their officers, all those different that flow out of state government services, driver services, DNR, state parks. All of those things will see an impact, unfortunately, when we go into this mode of having to make significant cuts. So it will, you know, everyone will see it. Everyone's seeing it in their billfold now because either their work is slowing down or their businesses are shuttered for a little while or whatever. But, you know, we solely rely on state taxpayer dollars as revenue to operate. And so when those numbers decrease, we don't have the ability or the option to figure out anything else to do but to reduce our spending.
James, you want to jump back in and then Tamar?
Yeah, I was going to point out another thing about this. The difference with school is that, and we saw during the Great Recession, is that schools have some options that the state don't have. I live in the city of Decatur, and we love our property taxes here. And so the school district in Metro Atlanta can raise property taxes, they can raise assessments. I mean, there are things that, you know, none of those are great, but there are things that can be done. I think the bigger question is that if you're in Randolph County or if you're in Stewart County, you don't have the property base, tax base to do that. So when the state says we're going to cut 14% of the money you have, you're cutting 14%. And I remember during the Great Recession, there were some of these places that were cutting out ROTC and cutting out band and cutting out, you know, various programs because they couldn't pay the teachers because they don't have any way around it, which is closer, I guess, closer to what the state is. I mean, the state can't raise property taxes, and they're not going to raise income or sales taxes,
well,
to raise more money.
Well, Terry, and that is a terrific point. This budget, you know, you had finally gotten to a point in the last years of Nathan Deal's tenure that there was great excitement about the fact that you were back to the point where you could fully fund the state education. And that meant that those school districts in other parts of the state that don't have much of a tax base were at least getting some more help from you all. But you're going to have to rethink that. And the other point that James makes that's important, I think, is the potential for whatever budget cuts you have to make, and you'll tell me if you think I'm right about this or not, this having a disproportionate impact, perhaps, on rural Georgia communities in a general way, as opposed to Metro Atlanta, although we know everybody's going to take hits. Terry?
Well, yes and no, Bill. The education funding formula that we use, Quality Basic Education Act, QBE, does have built into it an equalization formula that does try to offset the funding disparities between large metro systems where there's a large tax base versus those communities and counties that have smaller tax bases. Ultimately, it does have an impact there, but equalization does help, and sparsity grants as well with NQB help offset some of that, not all of it. But, James is completely right on that. You know, when you're looking at the city of Decatur and its tax base and what is called the per student wealth, which is the tax base divided by the number of students, and you come up with the per student wealth of the system. When you look at that versus some of the smaller counties in rural southeast Georgia, rural northeast Georgia, rural southwest Georgia, rural northwest Georgia. It does become an issue, but again, like I said, equalization does help offset some of that impact.
I will say that equalization, the biggest beneficiary of equalization is Gwinnett County.
It is. So, it is. Yeah. But they are, you know, they have a little over 10% of the total students in the state. And like you say, they are the biggest beneficiary. But I will tell you, when we adjusted the equalization formula about 7 years, 6 or 7 years ago now, it greatly, significantly decreased the amount of dollars that would be going to Gwinnett today, but significantly increased the number of dollars that would be going to the smaller systems because it became weighted more toward those smaller, poorer systems.
I have another question for Chairman England. We've been talking a lot about cuts, and obviously there's going to be a lot of painful cuts coming up in the months ahead. But I'm wondering about targeted investments at this point, because I've been writing a lot about contact tracing, for example, these last couple months, and there's going to be a real scale up at the Department of Public Health to help contain this this virus. And I'm wondering if there is going to be any room for investments in public health or anything that you think really does need to be a priority moving forward in terms of add-ons that maybe you weren't spending money on these last couple of years.
Yeah, I think we'll take a look at public health probably a little bit differently than we have in the past. It has certainly shown there, you know, what has been going on has certainly shown the importance of having a robust public health system out there across the state. And I think we'll take some long view consideration there at doing something toward revamping that whole system. That system has really not had a revamping in decades. I'm not sure that it's ever had one. James would remember back when it was created, probably in the 1890s. But I think we're going to have to look, you know, once the dust kind of settles and you've got the chance to kind of look back over your shoulder and see where you did really good and see where you kind of messed up, I think we'll have an opportunity then to look at, is there a better way or more strategic way to make investments there and go forward?
Do you have a sense already of where the gaps are, you know, where the state has had some shortcomings in the recent past that you think will need to be addressed sooner rather than later?
Not anything specifically. Some of it, of course, is manpower and just the ability to stand up a response. The other thing that's kind of coming out of this, too, is, you know, we're all joining virtually here on the radio show this morning, but we've seen a huge increase in the amount of teleworking that's been done, and I kind of segue from that into telemedicine. And we've got a very good backbone in public health and telemedicine. Some places more robust than others as far as capabilities there at public health at an office in a county. I think we'll look at certainly strengthening that system going forward. I know my wife is doing her physical tomorrow or Thursday one with our local physician via FaceTime. And then he's going to decide if any panels need to be run from that, you know, all of those kind of things. But telemedicine, we have huge capabilities there. We've just never really stepped up to the plate and said, okay, we're going to move toward doing that. And some of that's been because of the compensation model for the providers. A lot of those rules have been eased and changed during this, and I think they'll stay in place to allow Medicaid and Medicare dollars to flow a whole lot easier toward telehealth than what it has in the past, too. And public health would be a big piece of that.
Well, you bring up a really good point. I'm glad you mentioned Medicaid. You know, Mary Margaret Oliver was on the show a week or so ago, and she, I know she's a member of your committee, and she talked very passionately about the fact that she believes this is now finally the time for you all to look at not the waivers that the governor has requested, but a broad expansion of Medicaid to bring in federal dollars to help, in general, populations that are underserved, but also specifically in terms of the pandemic. Terry, is there any possibility that working with the governor's office, you are considering whether there should be a broader expansion of Medicaid? What's happening when Mary Margaret makes those passionate pleas in your Appropriations Committee hearings?
Well, Mary Margaret is an incredibly intelligent lady, and I enjoy working with her. You know, our policy doesn't necessarily mix sometimes, but at the same time, she has been incredibly helpful to me. She's got a ton of institutional knowledge and someone that I can lean on from time to time. And you know, a lot of issues that come before us are not partisan, and they're just right or wrong. And so she has been a tremendous help to me over the
years.
Well,
is Medicaid expansion right or wrong?
I think she and I probably disagree on that, and we'll continue to disagree on that. I've got some fundamental hang-ups on the Medicaid expansion piece in several different directions, but one of those is that we still know that Medicaid only reimburses with the provider fee plowback, only reimburses for about 86 cents on the dollar of expense. And it's kind of like the guy that was buying hammers for $3 and selling them for $2 and needed a bigger truck because business was so good. That's kind of what you fall into, that trap that you fall into with this. I do think that ultimately within the state of Georgia and within what we spend on health care today, that we have a way, if everyone would come to the table, we have a way to make sure that providers are being reimbursed and that individuals have access to health care without doing a Medicaid expansion.
We're kind of at the point where we said we would be glad to let you go. Let me ask you this. Are you open to one more question from James and Tamar? Or do you, if you need to go, we did promise we'd get you out of here.
Tamar, yes.
You know what? James, go ahead. Thanks, Sherry.
So this is a little bit offbeat, but I noticed during the lockdown that one of the places that seemed to be the busiest outside of grocery stores were the parks. And I'm wondering if I remember back in the Great Recession, a lot of the park, DNR got cut about 40 or 45%. I mean, they took a disproportionate amount. Do you see that an agency like that is going to have, are they going to have to, like, you know, limit hours and close parks and that kind of stuff to make ends meet?
That's a good question. Something that some of us had been talking about in the last week was, you know, we made that deep reduction to DNR, and actually they're still 11 or 12% shy of being back to their 2008 funding levels. I trust the commissioner to know how to manage through it. I know just riding by Fort Yargo State Park here in Bexar County, knowing that, you know, folks have been using it to go out and get out. You know, we may have to look at it a little bit different than we did the last time because of kind of our lifestyle changes and increased utilization at the park. So, you know, we're going to look at each one as we get to them individually and just see what we can or can't do.
Last question, Tamar.
So I want to ask the chairman just about all the other priorities that were there before this crisis hit, all the other things that James and myself and my colleagues read about breathlessly, like maternal mortality and teacher pay raises and paid parental leave and income tax cuts. My assumption right now is that all of those are being shelved. Is that your thought as well at this point, or is there room for any of these, even a scaled back version of any of these in the months ahead?
That's a good question, and I know that I'm not involved in as many of the discussions on some of the policy issues because we've been trying to figure out this budget. But, you know, when you come to the pay raises in general, because the House version had a teacher pay raise, but it also had a pay raise for state employees across the board, I know we're going to have to really look at that a lot different than what we had. Those may or likely will have to be delayed for a year. But some of the other issues, like maternal mortality in particular, I'm certainly hoping that we can figure out something to move forward there.
Terry England, you've stayed past the time that we promised we get you out of here. We know you're busy. You also have right now, along with your colleagues on the Appropriations Committee and the Senate Budget Committee, one of the toughest jobs in state government. So I really appreciate your taking some time to talk with us today, and we will watch as your committee moves forward with your budget plans. Thanks so much for being with us, Representative England.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill. Thank y'all.
Thanks.
Why don't we do this? Let's take a break, and we'll be back with more with James Salzer and Tamar Hallerman. AJC senior reporter Tamar Hallerman and James Salzer, who covers the budget like nobody else. He knows more about the budget than half the people in the state legislature, and they come to him to get details. So, James, we're very glad you could be here as well for this conversation. So, James, let me start with you. As we were talking with Representative England, something really hit me hard that we didn't get a chance to talk about with him. They're going to have to be creating a budget. They'll have figures from May. They won't have, I mean, by the time we get to June and revenue totals, they better have their budget in fairly good shape. I know they can still make adjustments before July 1st, but I don't even know how you make a revenue estimate based on these difficult times. The fact that despite Governor Kemp's best efforts to try to open the state back up for commerce, it's not happening quickly. I mean, we're still facing months of revenue shortages that could already blow up whatever budget they come up with that's supposed to start on July 1st. Am I assessing that correctly?
Right. I mean, I think months would be nice. I think it's probably going to be spreading into next year. I mean, they're going to be. It's a very difficult situation for them because of the time constraints. Because the governor is going to have to make a revenue estimate with maybe a month of coronavirus pandemic shutdown numbers, maybe. And we'll have no or little in the way of substantive numbers for, what's going on in May and none, obviously, in June. And so then he's going to make a revenue. He'll make a revenue estimate and say this is how much you can spend. The legislature will go forward. And it's really a guesstimate. I mean, it's a guesstimate any year because, I mean, every year you're essentially sure. Listening to your economist, and your economist says something, and he's right sometimes, or she is right sometimes not. This is really educated guess to the extreme. We don't really know how the world's going to open back up. We don't know when there's going to be a vaccine. There's a lot of people who don't. While restaurants and everything else are going to be open, people aren't going. They'll get a little bit of a bump in July from the income tax revenue that they didn't get in April. So that'll be a little bit of a boost. That'll be a few hundred million dollars probably. But other than that, good luck, which is why they're going 14%. I mean, they're going 14% because that's a pretty deep number, and I think Moody's Analytics gave them a range of like 12-15% reduction. So they're going deep with the idea of that. Hopefully, when they come back in January, they don't have to do more. Which was not
so. Let me just by way of comparison. Give me what was the governor's revenue estimate? It's gone in percentages. He right. Offers here's the percent of growth I expect to see. What was it in 2019? Do you recall off the top of your head?
I don't recall what it is. It usually is in the range of like 2-3%, and then this
2-3%.
Yeah, of growth. And so 2020, this year's budget, which ends. Month from now, end of June, had been, I think, 1 or 2%, and the governor lowered it without any idea that it was going to be a pandemic. He lowered it because there was a slowing of growth, and so they had lowered it to like a minuscule rate of growth that obviously is still not going to come in. So,
I'm sorry to jump in like that. Tamara, what's interesting about that is when Governor Kemp at the beginning or late last year told agencies unilaterally, he didn't come to the legislature to get their input on this, that they were going to take budget cuts, 4%
and six next year.
Between the supplemental budget for the beginning of this year and the new budget, 2021, the governor was excoriated by legislative leaders, by people in the community saying, why are you doing this? While it may have been pure, to some extent, there may have been some luck, but he also was foreseeing a downturn. He certainly didn't anticipate a pandemic, but it's beginning to look pretty good that the governor was scaling back on his expectations for revenue growth tomorrow.
I don't know if good is the right term, but certainly a little bit, because I remember even Republicans were, some Republicans were giving the governor a hard time for these budget cuts. And why are you cutting if we don't need to, if the economy is still in pretty decent shape? So probably not good is not the word I'd use. One thing I'd like to throw into the conversation that we really haven't talked about yet, the state budget needs to balance. They can cut, they can raise taxes, they can cross their fingers that Washington will give them some aid. But there is a reserve fund that the state has been building over the last couple of years, especially during the last few years of the Nathan Deal administration. And James, correct me if I'm wrong, it's something like $2.7 billion, and that's money that they could tap for something like this. The question is whether they really dig in deep now and kind of bleed it dry because of all the uncertainty right now. We just don't know how deep this crisis is. We don't know when Congress is going to send aid or if they're careful and they leave it for next year.
Yeah, the problem with that is
it? Yeah, James, the governor's office has been quiet about it.
Yeah, well, $2.7 billion may cover what they're losing through the end of this fiscal year. I don't think that they're going to be used. They are using it, and they will be using it to pay bills. But you don't want to. I mean, what happened in the Great Recession is they used like 70% of it in 1 year, in that first year, and then they were like, "Holy cow, this is going to go on for 4 or 5 years." So they'll use half or more that to get through the end of June. But then the question is how much they're going to have left for the next fiscal year, which, the numbers that I've seen, the shortfall could be $5 or $6 billion through this next fiscal year. So, including what it is, what this fiscal year, next year. So it is great. I mean, it's important that they have that. And a lot of states have nothing. I mean, there are some big states like Pennsylvania who have nothing in the bank, and I have no idea how that must not be a lot of fun to try to handle that.
This was a win. This was a money that Nathan Deal left behind because mm-hmm. James, better than anybody, Governor Deal did not allow agencies to take big increases, to call for big increases in their budgets. He asked them to remain stable. And as a result of that, he built, after the recession, built that fund back up to the 2.7 that Governor Kemp has right now. So, it's interesting to look back on Governor Deal's work on that. Let me ask another question. Both of you should jump in on this. When I asked Representative England if there is a possibility of a disproportionate impact on rural parts of the state, he pushed back, specifically in education. But isn't it not correct, James, that you talk about telemedicine. That's great. Let's expand telemedicine. But that presumes there's rural broadband in many parts of the state where there isn't rural broadband. The legislature has not been able to come up with a plan for funding rural broadband in any way. When it comes to health care and Medicaid expansion, It is often rural hospitals, rural health centers that suffer the most and face shutdowns or losses of services and staff because they don't have the money to continue. So although I know people across the state, James, are going to feel the brunt of the cuts, there is some truth to the fact that areas which are already suffering could see additional suffering. I think that's correct, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Chairman England is a champion for rural Georgia, so that I
absolutely
disagree with him on anything. I would say even the help that they give school systems, I just have to take what I've seen and what I saw during the Great Recession and how it the dispirited impact on rural schools that don't have and ironically, one of the school systems that I went to in Calhoun County, remember the Great Recession was an economic period. It was in one sense, it was a state budget period in a much longer sense. I mean, it lasted 5 or 6 years. And I remember going to a county in southwest Georgia and visiting the school system that had to cut back dramatically. And while I was there, their hospital closed down. And it was like, you know, you got two for the price of one here. You had a school system that was damaged, and you had a hospital that couldn't stay open. So I think any kind of recession or cutback just exacerbates the problems that Chairman England and others are trying to fix. And you have to remember also that those, for instance, the school systems, but in other areas in rural Georgia, the percentage of their funding that comes from the state is much greater than the percentage of funding in Atlanta City Schools or Cobb County or Gwinnett County, which gets much higher percentage of their money from property taxes. So that it's just natural that it's going to be a bigger impact.
Tamara, I got to get to a break, but before I do, I thought you asked an important question. You asked Representative England about some of the things that you have been writing about, others have been writing about, you know, dealing with maternal mortality in the state, dealing with teacher raises, dealing with income tax cuts. And he was very candid he said, I'm not involved deeply in all those policy issues, but we know that those programs are in great trouble right now. I mean, we had this opportunity to move forward on some of these important areas that, as you point out, may be jeopardized at this point.
Yeah, but I was very surprised when he mentioned that maternal mortality might still be on the table. That was extremely interesting to me. And that goes into the urban-rural divide that James was just mentioning. A lot of the women who are the most vulnerable are ones who are living in rural areas and don't live so near to so close to a hospital or don't have access to gyms or healthy food or a lot of that stuff. So I was very surprised to hear that. It also speaks to, right now, so much of our debate about racial differences and just right now the number of African Americans who are getting infected at much higher rates the deaths at much higher rates than whites here in Georgia and there's a similar divide with maternal mortality as well.
I don't want to be a cynic, but maternal mortality there is some partisanship involved in all of this, and Republicans are certainly hoping they can win women votes in the November election. And so you would think, Tamar, just to give you a quick second on this, that they recognize that that's an issue that women care about deeply.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, you talk to a Democrat and they say this would be far less of a problem if Georgia expanded Medicaid.
Right, exactly. All right, let's do this. We got to get a final break, the show out of the way. When we come back, a couple of really interesting polls that I'd love to ask Tamar and James to comment on. You're listening to Political Rewind. Welcome back to Political Rewind. Tamar, I do want to talk about the polling that I mentioned before the break, but very quickly, you filed a story in which you said that contact tracing can't get up to speed in time to catch the rapid spread of the virus. We haven't talked much about the coronavirus story today. Just give us a quick summary, and then we'll post a link to your article about this on our social media platforms. What are the concerns?
Sure. You talk to experts and they say that you need thousands of contact tracers in a state like Georgia to keep up with all of the infections that we have right now. And currently Georgia's logging about 700 new infections a day. And Kathleen Toomey, the director of public health in Georgia, mentioned that she wants to hire about 1,000 contact tracers. Now we only have about 250. So that's a rapid increase. But still, experts say you need many more than that to keep it in line. And there's a real question of whether the state will have enough tracers at the end of the day to trace every single case that comes up, or if right now they're going to have to focus only on vulnerable people living in nursing homes or folks working in hospitals.
All right, so we'll post that on our, as I said, our social media. James, you had an interesting story that despite lots of economic difficulties people are experiencing out there, Stacey Abrams' organization, Fair Fight Georgia, had a big fundraising quarter. They are continuing to raise a lot of money, yes?
Yeah, they've raised now $22 million since they started right after the 2018 election. The part that surprised me, they've kind of continued her tradition when she was a candidate, which is having a national, a broadband-based, following and tens of thousands of contributors. But what I guess I was a little bit more surprised about was they still raised $500,000 in April when the economy was shut down. I mean, $500,000 is more than, like, I think all the legislative candidates and statewide candidates combined in that month, and to me that's just amazing. One of the things they're doing is they're spending $2 million so far on setting up organizations at Democratic parties around the country to look at voting issues, and I forgot the exact title they used. They have people working in 19 different parties.
They're a powerful fundraising machine. Thank you. We can put that link up, too, for people if they want to see the story. You filed it a couple days back, but it's still a pertinent story. All right. I want to talk very briefly, because we're running out of time, about the Washington Post Ipsos poll, which was just released. It's a poll of they surveyed people in many states across the country and asked about the approval ratings for governors. And the lead of this article says basically this, that two states that voted for Donald Trump in 2016 are on different ends of the spectrum when it comes to how the people in those states feel about their governors. Mike DeWine in Ohio, a state that went for Trump, has an approval rating of 86%. People feel he has dealt with coronavirus in the best way possible. And they say on the other end of the spectrum, Georgia, where only 39% of the people surveyed by Ipsos approve of the way in which Governor Kemp has handled the virus here. That may be one of the, I think the governor is not going to be paying attention to this poll specifically, but Tamar, it's clear that this afternoon when he says he's going to keep some things shut, he wants to be a little cautious, because this poll was taken after the state basically was allowed to open for most businesses. Tamar?
Yeah, and that falls in line with a poll that that we saw in Georgia at the end of April from the University of Georgia that said roughly 62% of Georgia voters disapproved of Kemp's decision to ease a lot of the restrictions on restaurants, theaters, businesses, close contact businesses. So interesting to see it compared, though, with Ohio, which that's a comparison I've seen a lot because the population is about the same as Georgia's and it's a Republican governor.
Yeah, but what's interesting, James, is that Governor DeWine is now beginning to open up Ohio as well. The difference is he believes that people have felt confident for months now that he has taken the steps necessary to really control the virus, whereas in Georgia, we're still not certain whether the virus really is starting to recede, right?
Right. I mean, and we also, it seemed, if I remember correctly, I mean, he was active on this before we were. And so we kind of shut things down late. We're getting out early. It's a little premature because we don't know. The reality is experts can tell us this is a terrible idea, but we don't know. We don't know. They don't know. We don't know this is going to look like a month from now. So the governor is obviously taking a chance, but we'll see.
We've said all along that there are risks involved in opening. The governor is pleased and told us also in a news release that hospitalizations are down. The virus isn't spreading as fast as it had before, but everyone is waiting. The use of ventilators is down, but we're still waiting. We don't know what's going to happen in the next couple of weeks. So it's a gamble, and we'll keep on top of it. We are out of time for today's Political Rewind. James Salzer, I really appreciate your being with us. We look forward to your continuing to follow this budget for us. Tamar Hallerman, another Tuesday when I'm really pleased that you could be on Political Rewind. Thank you very much. Have fun with your dog, Winnie. We'll see you all soon. We'll be back on Political Rewind again tomorrow. Thanks to Tom Faust, Amber Mastaz, and Jesse Neiswanger for another noble effort of keeping this show on the air. See you all tomorrow.